Hello, I'm Kieran Valley.
And I'm Kate Valley.
This is Friday Night at Blockbuster, the podcast about our favorite movies from the 2000s. Except this is week one, part one of our three-part Best Picture winners at the Oscars in lead up to this year's Oscars ceremony. Like we said last week, this week we're going back to a movie from the 1990s because we've run out of movies to talk about from the 2000s.
A little bit.
that won Best Picture anyways. Before we get into the movie this week, though, today was the day that the BAFTAs were awarded, and because we are awards watchers, Kate, thoughts on the BAFTAs, initial thoughts, initial feelings.
So, taking kind of a quick look at the winners, it's a clean sweep for Oppenheimer and all things Oppenheimer. So, luckily, the person in our Oscar pool who has that, I think, has done quite well this year.
It's neither of us. I can say that.
Not us. I got two wins, so I'm happy with my two. So I'm not at the bottom of our list in our Oscar pool. I'm probably in the middle, which I'm okay with this year. So I'm just kind of starting to think ahead to the Oscars and trying to figure out, do I think they'll do another kind of clean sweep there? Or, like, Poor Things wasn't really on my radar, but, like, seeing how many awards it's won and that it, I'm wondering if it's going to be kind of the dark horse of the Oscars and maybe we'll pull out some wins where we didn't think they would. So,
well, like it's, we say it's a clean sweep. It's clean sweep because they ended up winning, I think, 7 or 8 awards.
Yeah.
They were the runaway most rewarded movie of the night. There are a couple interesting categories where they didn't win.
Okay.
So one that I'm just seeing here was Best Adapted Screenplay. They lost to American Fiction from Court Jefferson. It's a bit interesting that, you know, they didn't give it to Christopher Nolan, who is a British-born filmmaker. Yeah. They gave it to Court Jefferson. It's the best part of American Fiction is the script. So, like, it's a very worthy winner. I understand that.
Because you've now seen American Fiction, right? You've now seen all...
I've seen all 10.
All 10.
I've seen all 10. I'm slowly making my way through...
The rest.
The rest, which is every movie that's been nominated. Some are definitely easier than others. But, yeah, we'll see what number I get to there. Beyond adapted screenplay, things like costume design, things like production design, Poor Things won both of those against Oppenheimer. Again, a little surprising. Although, having seen Poor Things, you can't fault those wins. Like, the costumes and the production design of Poor Things is just
incredible,
staggering.
Okay.
It's staggering. Now, do I think there's a little bit of politics in play here? Because Poor Things is, I believe, a British-funded movie, or in part a British-funded movie. So, you know, that may factor in a little bit. But basically, yeah, the categories that we expected Oppenheimer to win in, it won in. And, you know, we're coming to the end here. And I don't know who's really going to put up a challenge for Oppenheimer on Oscar night.
Yeah, because I think we had talked before, the one that you were surprised who didn't get nominated for Best Actress was the woman from...
Lily Gladstone?
Yeah, yeah. Killers of the Flower Moon and stuff. So you were surprised she didn't get nominated, but... Emma Stone still a worthy winner?
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. Emma Stone would probably, of the people nominated, Emma Stone would probably be my number two.
Okay.
If I had had my ballot,
yeah,
Emma Stone would probably be number three.
Okay.
But yeah, like, Lily Gladstone was not nominated at the BAFTAs for some very strange reason. you know, might be part of their past. I don't know why they wouldn't nominate Lily Gladstone, but she was not nominated. So yeah, like, I think that category, Best Lead Actress, was like a foregone conclusion that it was going to be Emma Stone. So no real surprise there that she ended up winning that. Just a couple other interesting wins that I'm sort of picking out from the list here. Best Sound goes to The Zone of Interest, which is like a hell of a win. Because like that's what that entire movie is just the sound design. Like this, that it is so haunting and creepy and... it just, like, gets into your bones. It gets in under your skin, the way that they've layered the sound from that movie. Because it's a very strange movie. And the sound design is maybe the only part that I can point to where it's, like, that's pretty traditional.
Okay.
A lot of the other elements of the movie are not very traditional. So yeah, seeing that it won Best Sound, that's, you know, warms my heart a little bit, because it's a hell of a movie, a hell of a movie. Any that you're picking out, any that you're seeing that are interesting?
Well, I don't know if I've noticed this award before or not, but they have a Rising Star Award, which
yep.
I enjoy the idea of. And so they gave it to the woman out of How to Have Sex,
yep.
I think is the movie title. So that's just kind of a nice, different award.
Yeah, like I think that's just like a cool, different category that not many other award shows have.
Yeah, and then the other one that I was just looking at is documentary, The 20 Days in...
Mariupol?
Yeah, I don't know if I've heard much of that one.
The documentary stuff has kind of been all over the place. That has been long touted to be a contender.
Okay.
That's about, I think, the first 20 days or 20 days during the Ukraine war or something like that. So, yeah, I need to get my hands on some of these documentaries, because those have been the hardest ones to find for my checklist of movies that have been nominated this year. The Boy and the Heron won animated film. Yep. Hopefully this means good things for my guy Hayao Miyazaki at the Academy Awards. You know, it would be really nice, his last movie, if he got one more award. And original screenplay goes to Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall. And it's interesting looking at this here, because they have Barbie in the original screenplay category. But for the Oscars, Barbie is going to be in the adapted screenplay category. And so I think this basically opens up the door that Anatomy of a Fall is probably going to win that award.
Well, that'd be exciting. So it's, I'm excited. A bunch of the movies now, I've been keeping an eye on streaming services, because obviously I've missed them in theaters and stuff. But a bunch of them now are coming out to the streaming services in the next kind of couple of weeks. So we have a little list kind of on the back of the door for the dates that they're coming out, so that we can keep an eye on them. Anatomy of a Fall isn't going to be on one, but I think we're just going to bite the bullet and pay the rental.
VOD?
Yeah, yeah, pay the rental cost for that one, because it's one that has kind of been on our list as well to check out. So
it's very good.
Yeah, you've said.
It's very good.
So,
speaking of something that's not very good, though.
Good segue.
You recently, as in yesterday, went to go see Argyle.
Yep.
I have not seen a 2024 movie yet.
Oh.
So
this Wow, I beat you to it?
Yeah, this is the longest and the latest that it has taken me to go out and see a movie in like the current calendar year. So
okay.
Yes, you currently have seen more 2024 movies than I have seen.
Because I've now seen probably three or four.
Well, what else have you seen?
I've seen a few on like Netflix and things like that. So
I don't have Netflix, so those don't count. But with Argyle, I've heard the stories. I've read the reviews.
You've listened to people talk.
I've listened to the podcasts. Are they all true? Is it as bad as they say it is?
I was going to say, what are they saying? Because I don't listen to those things.
They're saying it's not very good, is what they're saying.
In your definition of good movies, it probably is not good. For the people that you listen to and you would appreciate their reviews or like really listen to them, yes, they probably don't love it. For me and Chris to go on a Saturday morning and take 2 hours to ourselves, it was a fun movie. And sometimes that's just what we look for. We've agreed it's probably not the greatest movie. I have in the back of my head, if you haven't seen it by like the end of the year, maybe I'll say it's my favorite movie of the year to make you watch it. So
what did you give it? What rating did you give it out of 5?
I probably give it a 3, 3.5.
3.5?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Because I've seen the movies you've given 3.5 to. Some of them are really good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was kind of what we were expecting up until, I would say, the last, like we often talk about acts and things like that, up until the last act when they do kind of the big twist of the movie. I didn't enjoy it after that. So the end of it was probably the worst part of it for me. The beginning 2/3 of the movie, I was just like, this is fun. It's exactly what I expect and exactly what I need today. So, yeah.
I will not be rushing out to go see it.
If I name it my favorite movie of the year, though, would you watch it?
No.
No?
No, because I know you won't. I know you won't. We'll find a better movie this year. Your tastes have slowly changed.
That's true.
So I think we can do better than Argyle. One movie that I'm not sure would be on your top of the movie list is the movie that we are going to talk about this week, because I happened to come over when you guys were halfway through, and the looks and sort of the confusion
and the struggles.
Like, yeah, I was like, I don't know if it's clicked with them as much as I had hoped it had. But anyways, it's a 1990 movie, but of course we get DVDs out of Blockbuster. That's the whole point of the podcast. Yep. So we are going to have to go back to September 27th, 2002.
Okay.
To talk about the 1992 movie Unforgiven, which won the 1993 Best Picture Oscar. So
there's a lot of dates.
There's enough dates there. There's enough dates there. Next week will be way more streamlined.
Yeah.
But yes, we are talking about Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven this week. The winner of the 1993 Oscar, which awards the 1992 movies. And so this was the big winner that year. This won Best Picture, won Best Director, and so on down the line. And so just before we really jump in, Kate, I just want to know, like, what'd you think of the movie? What'd you think of Unforgiven?
So when we came up with the idea of not necessarily doing 2000s Best Picture winners, but picking one from the 90s, the 2000s, and the 2010s. We did look at all of them and kind of, well, let's not do this because we've kind of done one similar. Let's not do this or whatever. And so I think I gave you the 1990 pick. I think this was the one that you wanted to do. And I was like, okay, let's do it. That's fine. I think I got to kind of pick one of the later ones.
I think you picked the 2010.
10 one. Yeah. And so this was Kieron's pick. He sold it to me as a Western, which I was like, cool. We haven't really done Westerns because they kind of went out of style a little bit.
Yep.
Although Kieron would have watched a lot of Westerns growing up with our dad. Not necessarily me. I don't have memories.
You were in on the John Wayne thing?
I don't think so. I don't have memories of John Wayne. I know he was there and I can kind of picture some of the VHS tapes on the wall. But I don't remember, like, key things of it all. And so I was like, cool, let's do a Western, something different. Let's see where this lies for me. I think the Westerns I have in my head aren't this kind of Western.
Which are? I'm going to put you on the spot. What are the Westerns that you were thinking of when you were watching Unforgiven?
So when I was like, it's a Western movie, I pictured two cowboys standing in a deserted town. Maybe not deserted, but everybody's hiding indoors.
With the duels.
And the tumbleweeds going across. And the, this town's not big enough for the both of us. And all of that. That was not this case at all.
Nope. That is not what Unforgiven is about.
And I kind of pictured, like, one of them riding off in the sunset on a horse, maybe with a woman, maybe on their own. But, like, I had that scene in my head. I don't think there's any sun in this movie. There's a lot of rain. So it just, it didn't line up with the Western images that I had in my head. Not to say that I didn't like it. I'm still kind of trying to figure out if I enjoyed it. Because once again, it gets back to me where I can appreciate what it's done and I can appreciate that it took a different look at Westerns and that it was a slightly different kind of tone. Am I going to go back and rewatch it though? Probably not. Am I in a couple of years going to be like, Briar, come on, let's go watch Unforgiven? Probably not.
That's where I come in.
That's where Uncle Kieron will come in.
That's where I come in.
But so that's where, like, for me, scoring it or ranking it is hard because
it didn't line up with what you thought a Western would do.
It didn't line up, but I can appreciate it. And so that's where it's like a little hard for me.
Can I
tell me I'm wrong?
Well, no, can I put this to you that is the exact point of Unforgiven is to not give you any of the Western mythology or tropes that at this point, I think like 90 something years of movies, like, basically, from the time that they were able to make movies, they were making movies about cowboys and the Wild West. So at this point, we had seen thousands and thousands of Western movies over 90, 100 years. And not to say that this was the first one to do it, because we might get into some other ones that are similar, but this was one of those movies where it's sort of like everything you think you know about the West, about the Wild West and cowboys and Indians and all this sort of stuff, you've gotten all that information from movies, but none of those are how it was in reality. None of those depict what it would be like to have to live out here by yourself and maybe not see anybody for months, have to go hunt for your food and figure things out. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen in Unforgiven, but like in other stories, like somebody falls off their horse and breaks their leg and it's like, you're dead, dude, because you're not getting to a doctor in time before that gets infected and things like that. Like,
well, technically one guy did. I think the horse got shot and the horse landed on him and he broke his leg.
He broke his leg.
So
exactly.
He happened to have friends around him at the time, but
yeah, he was also then subsequently gunned down.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. but like I think that's the whole thing that Unforgiven is trying to portray is how life in this time, in this part of the world, would have actually been. And it then can't give you any of the Western tropes that you are imagining or thinking of. Because, like, you're not wrong. Like, there are so many movies where the good guy in the white hat and the bad guy in the black hat
yeah,
stand 100 yards away from each other and wait and wait and wait.
And the tumbleweeds go across. And
the town is quiet. And you can hear the whistling of the wind.
Yeah.
And then within 3 seconds, they both draw on their guns and the good guy kills the bad guy. We've seen that a million times. But like, so for you to think that that's what a Western should give you, and then for Unforgiven to not give you any of that, that's the point.
And that's why the ranking or the scoring or my feelings for it is hard to explain and navigate. Because I think I went in with one idea of what I was going to get, and that's not what I get.
So
it's me just kind of being like, okay, let's give myself time to get my feelings and my mind to what they did present me,
yeah,
and not what I was hoping or what didn't they give me and stuff. So
it's probably an unsatisfying Western,
yeah,
for somebody in your position who was thinking they were going to get this over here and instead got that.
Yeah,
you thought you were going to get chicken and you got duck.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with duck. It's just not what you thought you were going to be eating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay.
And so I know before either when you came over and we were watching or whatever.
I kind of came like perfectly at the halfway point.
Yeah, you actually did.
Because a lot of what you said that night were things that you would then actually get in the next 20, 30 minutes.
And so like that was great. Like they ended up giving me some of those things a little bit later.
Yeah.
But I know the big thing you were trying to get across to me without kind of telling me a lot about the story was that Clint Eastwood would have done tons of Western movies that I had in my head.
Oh, yeah.
And so for him to come out and direct this and do something different and be like, well, I'm tired of doing this thing. Let's do this version over here was also why it's always talked about and remembered and things like that.
It's part of the reputation. The whole Clint Eastwood legacy part of this movie is, in some respects, it's probably the reason why this is heralded as one of the better anti-Westerns or dark Westerns or gritty Westerns, because there were movies that came out before this that did this same thing or very similar, at least. You know, you had like a lot of Sam Peckinpah's movies were like, this is not a fun time. Like the violence was horrific and we didn't know anything about medicine. Yeah. So like not only were you like dodging bullets, you know, left, right, and center, but if you did get hit by one, that was kind of it, because we didn't really know how to treat injuries like that. You know what I mean? You obviously have a few things like John Wayne, The Searchers and whatnot, where it's like John Wayne in most respects is like the antithesis to this. Like he was always giving you that good guy with a gun versus the bad guy with a gun sort of thing. He, like a lot of his movies were doing that. But every once in a while, he showed up in something like The Searchers, where you're like, this is, you know, he's not necessarily a hero. he might be our protagonist, but he's not necessarily a good guy. And that gives the audience like some conflicted feelings. Like, you know, that's John Wayne on the screen. John Wayne's the biggest movie star for 20 years, 30 years. But like what he's doing on screen is like, well, I don't really like that though. So, you know, how do I root for this guy? And like that is what Clint Eastwood is doing as William Money. Like he's the protagonist, but I wouldn't necessarily say he's the hero.
No, I think he tried at the start to be a good guy and stuff because he tried. So like we meet him because some young guy comes and is like, there's a bounty out for these two men. Yeah. You're the best that there ever is. Or best there was, I need some help and stuff. And the guy's like, William Money, Clint Eastwood says, I can't, I've got two kids here. It's pig season or the pigs are sick or something like that. Like, I can't come and help. You're on your own. And so the young kid rides off. And sure enough, then Clint Eastwood needs money to help the pigs and the kids and all of that. And he's, at one point when he leaves his two kids, I was just like, that's an interesting choice to leave your, I would say maybe 10-year-old and your 7-year-old alone, but
tells the 10-year-old like you're in charge, like no big deal. It's not that he's sending somebody to look after them. It's you look after your sister, and if anything bad happens, go to the neighbors who live like days away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, that's an interesting parenting choice, but sure.
It was a different time.
It was a different time.
It was a different time in a different place, Kate.
But so I think, like, he did at the start try to be a hero, a good guy. And it was kind of for me only at the end of the movie when an external thing happens, something happens to his friend, that then you kind of saw, oh.
The real him.
The real him, or like the him that he used to be before he met the wife and stuff like that. And so that then is like, he's not always been a good guy. And that's okay because he tried to change his way and maybe he'll change back. But don't mess with his friends. So,
well, I think that's one of the key parts of the movie is that Clint Eastwood's character at this moment is a former gunfighter. You know, he has this reputation of being one of the greatest of all time, but also like ruthless and dangerous and violent.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was always, he's constantly saying that he was always drunk and things like that. But when we meet him, it's been, I think it's 10 years since he'd had a drop of alcohol, since he'd killed somebody. Like he had tried to turn over a new leaf for this woman that he met and he fell in love with. But crucially, when the movie opens, she has been dead for a few years and he's kind of floundering. He's drowning a little bit because he doesn't know how to be this new improved good guy without her around.
Yeah.
And so he does go off on this trip for this bounty because he needs the money. And you can see throughout the whole course of the movie, like he is struggling to still be this guy that he has been for 10 years, even though circumstances are pushing him in the direction of his former self. And then it's at the end of the movie where he kind of embraces, he's like, no, I am the bad guy. Actually, yeah. I am the evil person that you should all be afraid of. That's when everything like goes right for him. It's true. Like in that moment where you're just sort of like, oh, he's like fully embraced. No, this is who I am. And that's when it all works out.
Yeah.
And you're just like, God, like, I don't know what message they're trying to tell me here, but like, it's not a nice one. It's not a nice message. But I think like the thing, you know, we can get into individual moments or whatever, but one of the things I love just to stay with Eastwood in the beginning here is like I was saying, like Eastwood at this moment, one of the biggest movie stars at the time, one of the biggest directors at the time. He had done 30 something years of Westerns where he was always the hero. He always prevailed. And the first thing that we see from him in this movie is him falling over in pig shit.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, like this is not.
He's Clint, okay. Not looking pretty.
Yeah. Like this is not the Clint Eastwood that I thought I was going to be getting based on the work he's done for 30 years. This is not. This is not the man with no name from the Leone movies. This is something really different. And so for somebody like me who has watched a lot of Westerns in my life and sort of grew up with them, like I've joked, but like John Wayne Westerns were kind of my Disney movies.
Yeah.
I was watching those from like 3 and 4 years old. When I first saw Unforgiven, probably 15, 16 years ago. Like, I was probably a teenager.
Okay.
I remember that moment because it's not the first scene of the movie. It's like we're like 10 or 15 minutes in, I think, at this point. When we first meet Clint Eastwood. And I remember being like, oh, fuck. Like, oh, what's going on here? Because, like, that's not a hero.
No.
Or at least he's not trying to be or not, you know, there's no vanity about looking like one. And so I do remember that moment when, you know, we first meet him and he's covered in pig shit and he's trying to corral sick pigs away from the healthy ones. And he's not doing a very good job of it. You're sort of like, oh, this is different. This is different. I'm going to take note now. This is something wild.
So I'm just trying to get, because for me watching this, when I saw him for the first time, I actually didn't recognize him because I only have like old Clint Eastwood in my head.
Which is funny because when he made this, that kind of was the whole thing. It's like, oh, Clint Eastwood is part of this thing is that he's too old to be that Western hero.
And I think I joked about him being a young Clint Eastwood to you. And you're like, Kate, he's not young in this. And I was like, but for me, this is the earliest I've seen him. So he is young for me in this. So he acted for what, kind of 20 years and then started directing and now subsequently does like both?
Yeah.
Is that kind of how his career?
Yeah. Like I don't have the things up in front of me, but like he was like on TV for a long time. Then he started making movies about the 60s and became a big, big star. Like that's when he made the Leone movies. That's where he made like Good, Bad and the Ugly and things like that in the 60s. Then we get to the 70s and he starts making things like the Dirty Harry movies. And you're just like, oh, this guy is quite literally the A++ list in Hollywood. You know what I mean? And it's about the 70s, I want to say, or maybe the late 60s, but early 70s, where he starts directing movies. And a lot of the first few movies that he directs are kind of like, they're not classics. We'll say that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, they are still good and there's things in them, but it would take him a few years where you could sort of then be like, oh, he's getting good now. Like, either the scripts he's grabbing or the way that he's directing, like, he's getting better. You can see a progression in it. And so at this point, this is like him at the peak of his powers and he gets a Western. Well, he says that he'd gotten this Western years before, but was actually, he felt like he was too young. So he waited, I think he waited about 7 or 8 years to make the movie. And you're sort of like, yeah, this was the perfect moment for him to act and direct in this movie about this subject matter and all this sort of stuff. And he more or less only directs now. The funny thing about Clint Eastwood movies and most people who act in them always say this is like, he kind of does one or two takes and then he moves on. Like he doesn't really mess around with multiple setups or takes of a certain scene. He's sort of like, no, we got it. We're good. And that leads to certain things where you're like, oh, that's perfect. Or, you know, he catches little moments that if you were always setting up, you might not see. But then in other movies, you're like, should have done a third take. Maybe do one more on that one, Clint.
Yeah.
So yeah, there have definitely been a few movies recently where I'm sort of like, oh, you know, he is like in his 80s, 90s, I think, at this point, where you're sort of like, yeah, it makes sense.
He's 93.
93 years old. Like, that is impressive. And he's still making movies. He's got one coming out this year, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a give and take thing with Clint. Some of them are like really, really great. Other times you're just like, I didn't like that one.
Okay.
But Unforgiven is great. Yeah. So the first half, because this is how I'm going to kind of break down my head.
Okay.
You had seen the first half before I happened to come over the other night.
Yeah.
And so like, what were your feelings on the first half? Because the first half, it's a lot of, I can understand, like, it is maybe a bit slower moving, especially compared to the second half.
Yeah.
But it is giving you a lot of information in terms of, like, who these characters are, what they're doing, what their relationships are. And for me, like, that's just as good as the gunfights that we eventually get.
Yeah, I think I would have liked it, like, mixed up a little bit. and so, no, the first half is, yeah, very much character building. We get introduced to the women in the brothel, I guess, which are kind of like the start of the movie. And that's what the whole movie kind of revolves around, is one of them gets cut up by a guy.
Yeah.
And then the bounty goes out on the two guys who attacked her. So I enjoyed them and kind of their story because I was, I kind of almost wanted a little bit more information on them, on like, how did you all get to this place? Like, you guys don't seem heartbroken that you are here. So like, maybe you guys are okay with this line of work.
They would, or like, they would often get brought and then left.
Yeah.
So I think, like, yeah, like the more sort of these stories that you read, they were probably traveling with somebody or in a group of people on their way to California.
Oh, okay.
And they all stopped in Big Whiskey, which is at the town. And then the women didn't have any money to continue or didn't have any skills to continue the journey. So like, whoever they were traveling with just left them there.
Okay.
And so now, and now you're sort of like, well, you're left in this town. You don't know anybody. There's not a lot of businesses around. So like, what do you do?
Yeah. Cause the one woman that we meet, Delilah, I think is her name.
Yep.
She ends up kind of being referred to that as property because she was brought out by the guy who owns the brothel.
Yeah.
And so the whole women stuff at the beginning was a bit tough to watch.
Because, I'd forgotten it starts like that, to be honest.
Because, like, she gets cut up, which, like, already is a tough start.
Yeah.
But then the two guys get kind of tied up, and we get to meet
Little Bill.
Little Bill.
Yeah, Gene Hackman's character.
Yeah, Little Bill. And he kind of comes in and is like, well, this beat up is just worth 5 ponies or whatever. But not to the woman that got cut up. No, no, to the guy who owns the woman.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Different time, different place, Kate. Different time, different place.
And so, like, kind of getting a bit more of their story, I would have just been interested in, like, the dynamics of that. I couldn't quite, maybe I missed scenes on Little Bill. I couldn't quite figure out his whole character background and just, like, why he was so, like, he was just kind of a big bully.
Yeah.
In some ways. And stuff. So, like, I don't know if he thought he was bigger than Whiskey Town or whatever the place was called again.
Big Whiskey.
Big Whiskey.
Yeah.
And so, like, thought he should have been out of there by now, or was he happy there? Like, him I couldn't quite figure out. And then I enjoyed Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman, though.
Yeah.
I enjoyed them together. I thought their scenes were really good.
Okay, so we'll hold on to them for a second.
Okay.
Because I also agree.
Okay.
They're fantastic. The Gene Hackman stuff. So I think the movie gives you enough information to sort of fill in enough blanks about who he is and what he's up to. But obviously the more you consume these movies, the more you read these books and things like that, you can start to sort of be like, I also imagine that this might also be part of his
kind
character.
Of like fit in more puzzle pieces.
Yeah,
in a way.
Like it's not necessary to enjoy the movie or know anything about the character, but it does just allow you to sort of give this backstory that may exist, may not exist, who knows. I imagine that Little Bill was a former gunfighter in much the same way that William Money is, in much the same way that English Bob was. He probably came to Big Whiskey and proved his skill and his talents in such a way that he was then immediately given the job of sheriff. And I think that is part of why you conceive him as this big bully, is because he is the most powerful person in the town.
Yeah.
What he says goes, one, because he's the law, two, because he's clearly the most skilled person with a gun. So nobody is going to question him. Nobody's going to sort of rise up, because you'd either fear getting stuck in jail or dying.
Yeah.
Right? So this has given him an ego. This has given him... He walks around like cock of the walk or whatever, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, he spends most of his time out building his own house.
Building his own house. Which,
leaving his deputies to do shit.
Do shit. And like, I think it's like a fun little detail that he's actually not very good at that. Like,
oh, no, I love that when the house is like leaking and water is pouring in. Yeah, that was great.
He's building this house. And to the point where we finally see him building the house, I think we've gotten 2, maybe 3 scenes where he's kind of like the ultra like macho man. And then you see him building this house and you're like, oh, he's an idiot. He's just good. Like, he's just good with a gun is his thing. So, yeah, I think the key part or the interesting part about the opening scene where we meet Little Bill and he rounds up these two guys who have cut up the woman is that 9 times out of 10, he's the hero of the movie. He's the town sheriff where this horrible violence has happened to a woman. He's going to be the good guy. And we very quickly realize, oh, he's not the good guy. Like, we don't know. I don't necessarily know if we know how evil he's going to be, but we definitely know that he's not the good guy.
I think you start to get an idea because clearly the women want some form of retribution, something.
Yeah.
Once they realize that they're not obviously going to get the ponies because she's property to the other man, whatever. He initially says he's going to whip them.
Yeah.
And like the women were like, not great, but okay.
Yeah,
like,
they were not happy about that.
No, even but like, we'll with. Take
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And then once the decision is, no, they get the ponies instead, the whipping thing goes out the window. And then the women are like, wait, hold on a second.
They're not
like,
even going to get whipped.
They're not even going to get whipped. Yeah. Like, they've cut her up and all of this. She now won't be able to work anymore.
Yep.
And nothing happens to these two guys. So, like, at that moment, you're just like, oh, there's something. For me, I picked up that moment as, like, there's something else happening in this town.
Well, like, he just completely, he understands that the guy who owns the saloon and is in charge of these women, he needs to keep him on his side. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In a town that small, the people who own the businesses are the ones that you're actually working for. And so when the guy brings up the fact that he had spent money to like bring her out and she owed this money and he was, you know, entitled to this money or whatever, that's when little Bill is like, okay, they'll get 3 horses, you know, or 5 horses.
Yeah.
And you can sell them. You can do whatever you want with them. And that'll pay for the bill. And then we're all good to go because she doesn't factor in at all.
No.
Justice for her is doesn't exist.
Yes. It's irrelevant in this time and place.
It's justice for him. And so, yeah, I think when you start to see that, like, not only, like, it's a really interesting thing because there's a part of you after seeing what they've done where you're just like, yeah, I do want corporal punishment on these guys, which is awful to think about, really. But then when they take that away from you, you're just like, no, fuck that.
Yeah.
And sort of like that just, that's what this movie does. It puts you in these positions to be like, what you actually want is kind of barbaric, but we're not even going to give you that. And we're going to make you upset that you're not getting it.
I think what then kind of goes on is all of these people, obviously the women put out a bounty for the two guys looking for their own retribution, their own vengeance. I kind of then get the impression that a lot of cowboys or a lot of people end up coming to the town to try and find these two guys.
Yep. Well, it's $1,000.
It's $1,000.
Yep.
But then obviously the women don't have it, and that's another point in the story. But Bill and these other cowboys then almost are trying to protect the two guys. And that's, I got a little muddled there. I got a little confused on like why they were then trying to protect the two guys who did cut up the woman.
I think it's purely for Gene Hackman to be like, I'm still the big dick in town.
Okay.
I mean, like, if somebody else came in and provided the justice that I had denied, all of a sudden, what does that mean for my standing?
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, and everybody in town would know that they did something that I refused to do.
Okay.
It doesn't look great. You know what I mean? So he then becomes this character that actively dissuades people from coming to town and collecting on this bounty.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of like, wow, like he is a fucking evil person. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even that he won't do this himself or that, you know, whatever the transaction had been completed, he could kind of wash his hands of it. Let somebody else just go kill these guys and get $1,000 from the women.
Yeah.
He won't even let that happen. He won't let that happen.
That was the only part. Like, I followed a lot of the movie and everything like that. It was just kind of the nuances, I guess, in his story that either I got a little lost in or I didn't fully understand the whole reason why he was doing certain things.
There is also like the part that like he's pretty sadistic. So he enjoys the power that he has over people. He enjoys inflicting pain on people that he knows can't really fight him back.
Yeah.
It's not even a skill or a talent thing. Like everything that he does with English Bob.
Oh my God, that was awful to watch.
But like English Bob has definitely like inflated his own reputation, inflated his own past for the guy who's writing the biography on him.
Yeah.
But he probably still knows how to fire a gun. He's probably still pretty good at it. So it's not that he couldn't kill Little Bill in a one-on-one fight, but it's sort of just like, why take the chance?
Yeah.
Why take the chance? And so when that is already in Bob's head, that's when little Bill is like, I'm going to pounce on this because I know you're not actually going to fight me back. So I'm going to go way over the top in my treatment to you.
Yeah. Speaking of English Bob real quick.
Yeah.
Also again, young for me.
Yeah, young.
Totally didn't recognize him. Richard Harris. No idea that he was in this until somebody else pointed it out to me.
This was only what, like 8 years, 9 years before the Harry Potter movies?
Like, but it's because he was missing the beard and like I just couldn't even recognize him. So
all the hair was in the back. He had beautiful long hair. Okay, so you brought up William Money, you brought up Ned, Morgan Freeman's character. Those are definitely some of the best parts of the entire movie. Just the two of them hanging out, talking, riding together. Because the other thing is that I like about the movie is that it depicts how long it would take to get to these places. So they do spend the first 40 minutes traveling from where they live to Big Whiskey because it's like probably 1,000 miles.
It's just Kieran enjoying the cattle driving and the long roads between towns.
I finished the Larry McMurtry Lonesome Dove novel like the day after watching this, and I was just like, oh, like I was just so in my element.
But yeah, no, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that it wasn't just like, we've left our homes, we've left our kids and Ned's wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Partner. And it wasn't then just like one scene of them in the horizon and now they're in the town. Yeah. Like that would have, you need a little bit of them like getting there and stuff. And so then they obviously run into the kid again.
Mm-hmm. And they were trying to find him.
They were trying to find him. And so they finally caught up to him. And the kid's just randomly shooting in a field.
Yeah. Well, the kid can't see anything.
Because then they realize the kid can't see anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, that would suck for that person. Like that kid, like not in this time, in this place, as we'll just kind of keep saying, like to not be able to see a distance would be awful. Like.
Well, again, like I think the other part of the movie or one of the things you always have to think about is like, what are people saying about themselves? And then what is the reality?
Yeah.
And so like with a lot of these characters, they present themselves in a certain way, but then we actually find out that the reality is not that at all. And with the kid, with the Schofield kid, he's like, yeah, I'm the fastest gun in this state or in this county. And I've killed five people. And then we find out that he can't see anything.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like, okay, like, so on one hand, he might be saying that to make him feel better about himself.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he's probably putting that out there in the world so that nobody tries to draw a gun against him.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like, well, he couldn't see them anyways. So the best defense is a good offense. He's putting out there that nobody wants to fight me because I'll kill you. And so therefore nobody fights him, which is good because he couldn't see who's fighting him anyways.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to point a gun in the right direction.
Yeah. That's why I love this movie. But yeah, like so many of their scenes together, because you'd heard a little bit, I think, about the fact that they had this long sort of partnership together. But you need to sell it. You need to drive that home.
Yeah.
And so there are so many scenes of the two of them just sort of riding beside each other. And one would start a story like, oh, do you remember this? And like, oh, yeah, I remember. And they just go back and forth. Or, you know, I remember you killing three people that day, not two people. And like, sort of like, oh, there is a very, very shared history between these two guys. And like that then... You need to drive home that friendship because what ends up happening in the second half of the movie, it needs to make sense.
Or even like when they run into the kid and at first, I think it's Clint Eastwood's character is like, well, we're going to split the $1,000 three ways.
Yeah.
And the kid's like, no, I came looking for you. You brought him. Like his share will come out of yours. And he's like, well, then we're going to go home. Like we're partners.
Exactly. They were both willing to like drop it. Yeah.
If you don't want me, both of us, you're not getting me because where he goes, I go and vice versa. And like that I enjoyed. And then even after Clint Eastwood got beat up by little Bill, once again, the kid then goes to Ned and is like, well, me and you will go find the two guys. And he's like, no, I'm not going anywhere without him.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So like you do kind of get the feeling that in some way, maybe they've kind of almost become brothers. Like they are best friends.
Yeah.
They look out for each other. And you need that in this kind of story. Otherwise, it is just a lot of single guys, solo guys going after money. Like, you need that kind of friendship and that bond.
Okay, so then the second half now. So we've set everybody up. We know who everybody is.
Yeah.
The second half, when I then left, did you start to get the movie that you thought you were getting? Because we start to get some gunfights. We start to get a little bit of violence. We start to get a little bit of those tropes that we would associate with a Western movie. I would argue, or I would say, they still give it to you just slightly different, just in a way that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, so like I'm thinking of the scene where they run into one of the guys, the first guy. I can't remember who the first one is that they meet.
I think the first one's Davey, but I can't remember the second guy's name.
And stuff. And so they run into him. They pin him down. I think they either shoot the horse or they shoot him and the horse falls. That's the guy who breaks his leg.
Yeah.
I then enjoy he crawls behind rocks or whatever. And his friends want to get to him, but they're scared about being shot.
Yeah.
And the three guys are like, we're not here for you guys. Like, you go help your friend. You go give him some water. We won't shoot you. We just need him to die. And stuff. And it's kind of like, sure. Like, because the other guys aren't part of the bounty. Like, why kill them? They don't need to be killed. So.
I think that the big thing with that scene and a lot of the violence in this movie is that it stays there. So, like, we see it happen. We see him. Well, first of all, like you were saying, I think the horse gets shot and killed. And the horse falls on his leg, and so he breaks his leg. And so he's, like, agonizingly crawling behind rocks to shield himself. And they keep firing, they keep missing, and they finally get him. They shoot him through the gut, and he just slowly starts to die.
Yeah.
And we don't leave. We don't leave the scene. We don't go to triumphant music as they're riding back into town. Like, you know, one down, one to go. It's like, no, we're sitting here.
And we're gonna waiting for this moment.
We're gonna hear him cry out for his friends and water.
Yeah.
And we're gonna see the faces of Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman, who have killed lots of people. The Schofield kid we eventually find out has killed nobody.
Yeah.
But like nobody's happy.
No.
About this situation. Like even the people who have done it so many times before, you just see it on their face. It's like, fuck, like it's another one. Well, and like, they're not happy about it, but this is the life. This is the job.
Well, that's the thing. Like, that one, I'd be intrigued to know more of kind of Ned's backstory and things like that. That one, like, really seemed to affect him because
he couldn't even take the shot.
He couldn't take the shot.
Yeah.
I think he did the initial one and then couldn't do the subsequent one. And so then he kind of removes himself a little bit and sits on a rock and faces the other way when the rest of this is happening. And you are kind of just like, oh, I guess because Clint Eastwood's character has been out of the game for 10 years, he's probably been out of it too. So, like, this just isn't his life anymore. No. Like, he's purely here because his friend came in and said, I need you to come with me. I need another set of hands in a way. So,
crucially, like, we see in the first few scenes, like, Will's farm is not doing very well. No. But Ned's is. Ned's looks okay. So, like, maybe Ned is good at this farming thing. And, like, he fully cannot take the shot and kill this person that he doesn't know. And he's kind of, like, the moral center of the movie. Like, of all the characters, he's kind of the only one that you can point to and be like, I think he actually has changed and is happy with the change and okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, all that sort of stuff. Everybody else is kind of murky. But, yeah, so they kill one. It's long. It's agonizing.
It's real slow, yep.
It's a real slow death. They go to the second one.
Well, Ned goes home.
Yeah.
I think we need to mention that because subsequent scenes happen to Ned. So Ned tries, leaves.
Yeah, Ned tries to leave. The Schofield kid and Will track down the second person in the bounty. And the thing that I love with this one is that he sends the Schofield kid in because we still don't know that he's kind of full of shit.
Yeah.
At this point. And the guy is in the outhouse, and he opens the wrong door.
Yeah.
And he's not in the section of the outhouse that he thought he was in. And that's when the alarm bells, I think, start going, be like, this kid
is not good.
Yeah, there's something off about this kid. They kill the second guy.
On the shitter. Yeah.
On the shitter.
Some way to go.
He goes out Tywin Lannister style. There's a little bit of a gunfight, but they're basically just trying to get the hell out of Dodge. They go back to collect their money because they've now killed the two guys. And this is when we find out that when Ned tried to leave, he was captured. He was taken to Little Bill and Little Bill killed him.
Yeah. Because he was getting whipped for information.
Yeah.
I think just for names. Well, mainly. Because, like, I guess at this point, like, nobody would know who each other were.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, there was a small scene or an earlier scene where the three of them were in Big Whiskey and Will was caught with a gun. There's no guns allowed in Big Whiskey. And Will was beaten up, but Ned and the Schofield kid get away. And so they know that these three guys are kind of in the area. They know that they're here for the bounty.
And that they're together.
And they know the gun that was used to kill the first guy. And that's the gun that they find with Ned, because that's Ned's gun.
Okay.
And so that's how they know, okay, Ned is one of these three guys. So we need the names of the other two. And so they torture him and they kill him. And when Clint Eastwood finds out about this,
it's not a good day.
He's not a happy guy. And it's not a good day for the citizens of Big Whiskey.
But yeah, so I think that was kind of, we then get the scene, which is more what I had in my head.
Yep.
Like the Western would be. I still didn't picture it in the pouring rain.
I love that. I love that. Like, it just is so miserable and so depressing. And like, I think you know that, okay, we're getting a big gunfight here, which is kind of why you've sat down in the first place to watch a Clint Eastwood Western. But they're sort of just like, nah, you're not really going to enjoy this.
Yeah.
Because nobody in the scene's really going to enjoy this. And it's going to be wet and miserable and dark.
I just kind of love that, like, they set it to the rain. So he rides into town and obviously sees Ned in the coffin. And this is what happens to assassins or killers or something. Something's written on the sign to kind of call him out about it all. And so then he goes into the brothel where all the guys are celebrating.
He goes into the saloon.
The saloon.
Yeah.
And stuff. And so the billiards place, I think, is what the cover is. And he finds out who the owner is.
Yeah.
He immediately gets shot dead. And then everybody's like, oh, who's that? Like,
he was unarmed.
He's unarmed. And all the guys now take notice on Clint Eastwood's character. And then, yeah, he very quickly then goes around and shoots, I don't know, six people, five people?
I think he kills about five. It is set up earlier in the movie. So, you know, we've glossed over sort of a big section because ultimately it doesn't really factor into the main storylines. But there is a biographer in town and he's trying to learn about the West and gunfighters and things like that. And he eventually hooks up with Gene Hackman's character who sort of tells him stories. And you get the sense that Gene Hackman's character, much like Richard Harris's English Bob, is kind of inflating himself up a little bit. That's kind of his character. And he tells him one of the things in a gunfight. It's not who can draw the fastest, but who can keep sort of a calm head, because that means you won't miss.
Yeah.
If you're drawing too quickly, you'll miss. And now you've fired and they'll get a shot back or whatever. And in this scene, because it is a little, it's on the edge of ridiculous.
Yeah.
That he comes in and kills six people without anybody shooting him.
Yeah.
He doesn't get hit at all.
I don't think there's one shot at him. Like,
no, there's a few shots.
Oh, is there?
They
miss?
The other people get shots off.
Okay.
But that's the thing, is that they miss because they are scared.
Yes.
And he's not. He's done this a million times.
Yeah.
And so, yes, he shoots at Little Bill first, takes out Little Bill, and the rest of the people who are brave enough to even shoot in the first place are too scared, and they just miss him, and he just goes around the room and kills them all. And then he goes back and he kills Little Bill.
But he gives everybody else a chance to get out. He kind of is just like, whoever...
whoever is not really involved...
leave.
Take off. Yeah.
And stuff. And I was like, I appreciate that. Because once again, similar to killing the first guy at the Rocks, if you're not involved in this, he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. Yeah.
He doesn't want to kind of waste his time. He doesn't want to waste his bullets. Just go on. And then, sure enough, he goes outside and sits on the horse and calls out, you better bury Ned properly and stuff. And I was like, that's him still looking out for his friend.
Well, like, I did think that scene or that moment, I was sort of like, oh, you won't take Ned home to his wife.
I thought of that too, but then I was just like...
Fair enough.
I thought of that too briefly, but I think it would just be like dragging him in the coffin and...
Yeah, like it's a long journey.
It would be impractical.
Yeah. At that stage, at that moment, when he's leaving Big Whiskey after everything in the saloon, like, that's when he becomes that sort of devil figure where there are people in the town with guns and they're pointing them at him, but nobody is willing to take the shot.
Yeah.
Nobody is brave enough to take the shot at this guy who's just sitting on his horse.
Yeah.
He's not even, you know, he's not got guns out. He's not moving around. He's just sitting on his horse, but nobody, because they've all seen what he's just done. And like, that is, when I say that, like, this movie might not have heroes, like, that's kind of my point.
Yeah.
Is that like, yeah, he's the protagonist. And because of what we see Little Bill do, you kind of hope that Little Bill dies in the end. But there is like no part of me that's cheering for Clint Eastwood's character. He's there to kill two guys for money. Like, yeah. He's not a good guy.
That's true.
So I just love that, like, that's how they still close it kind of on that idea. It's not like he's running out of town and people are sort of like, oh, thank God.
Cheering. Yeah, like, we've been liberated from.
Yeah, like, Little Bill really sucked. So, like, thanks for that. It's sort of like, no, like, they probably liked Little Bill. Like, the thing about Little Bill is that.
He
probably protected the town pretty well because he was willing to do this stuff.
Yeah.
They were probably, you know, yes, they were probably a little afraid of him. It's a little bit of a fascist thing going on. They were probably a little bit afraid of him, but at the same time, they were also probably safe. And now he's just taken that away. This guy who's just rode into town. Nobody really knows who he is.
Yeah, that's true.
And like, that's how the movie ends.
Well, that's not how it ends.
That's not how it ends. But so, but that's like, that's the last big moment.
So that's the last big moment. Because it does start and end with his house or his farm in Sunset and words going over the screen.
Yeah.
Talking about.
I think it almost makes it feel like a book.
Yeah. Is that what the idea of that was?
I think so. I think so. It's kind of just to give you a little bit of introduction to the story and his character without having voiceover. I think voiceover in this
time just wouldn't have been.
It would just feel, you'd sort of be like, oh, that doesn't make sense. Like,
oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Because it does, the movie does start with words going over the screen talking about.
Maybe this is, what's his name? Beauchamp?
Oh,
maybe this is his book.
Maybe this is his book. But talking about a woman who ended up meeting a guy and marrying him against kind of her parents' wishes.
Yeah.
And they always thought that the guy was evil and would kill her. And she does die, but not because of him.
Not because of him, yeah.
And then we get the words at the end of the scene where I think her parents finally do make it to the place where she lived. Has subsequently found out either she...
She was dead.
She was dead. I think they only find out then.
But they had all left.
But they had all left and maybe moved out to California or whatever with their $1,000. So
yeah. Well, 500. He would have split it with the Schofield kid.
Well, I kind of wondered if the Schofield kid stuck around and like hung out with them.
Maybe.
Because he did send him back to the farm to be like...
To look after the kids or make sure they're okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of wondered if he took him under his wing a little bit. Who knows?
So we're here to really talk about the Oscars. This was an Oscar winner, big Oscar winner. 1993 wins Best Picture. I'm curious, how many of these have you seen? So it beats Howard's End, The Crying Game, A Few Good Men, and Scent of a Woman.
Do you want to guess?
Yeah, my guess was zero.
Yeah.
And that was pretty confirmed. So I have not seen Howard's End. Howard's End, I think, is like a Merchant Ivory movie. Like, I think you knowing what I know about Merchant Ivory movies, you might actually enjoy Howard's End.
Okay.
The Crying Game was a bit of a phenomenon in 1992, 1993. Had one of the big twist endings at that time that like nobody saw coming.
Okay.
I'm not really going to say anything more. I did see The Crying Game when I was probably a little too young to fully understand what was going on. But the twist still was like, whoa, fuck, okay. So Crying Game, pretty good. A Few Good Men, I think you'd fucking love A Few Good Men.
I think that's the courtroom scene.
Yes.
You don't know the truth.
Or you can't handle the truth.
You can't handle it. Yeah. So it's been on my list to watch for years.
I think you'd really love it.
Because I think I always mix it up with a different movie. And I can't remember now what. I think it's like 12 Jurors or something.
Oh, 12 Angry Men?
12 Angry Men, I think.
Okay.
So I think I always mix them up.
Well, easy way to not mix them up. A Few Good Men takes place in the courtroom. 12 Angry Men takes place outside the courtroom.
Oh, okay.
That's about it. Scent of a Woman, it's not very good. Scent of a Woman is not a very good movie.
Okay.
Yeah. Eastwood loses to Pacino for Best Actor.
Yep.
For Scent of a Woman. This was kind of his makeup career retrospective Oscar. Denzel Washington probably should have won for Malcolm X. Probably should have beat both of them.
Oh, okay. In
hindsight. As you know, as we get further and further along, I think more and more people look to what Denzel was doing in Malcolm X and was like, that's actually better than both of them.
Okay.
Hackman, though, does beat Al Pacino for supporting actor, which...
Oh, because he was in both categories.
Okay. He was in both. And actually, I think Pacino should have beat Hackman.
In that category.
In that category. Okay. Like, Hackman is really good as Little Bill. I fucking love Hackman as Little Bill. But Pacino in Glengarry Glen Ross is fucking great. Okay. He's so awesome. And then Eastwood wins director.
Yeah.
One of two that he would eventually win. I think he ended up winning again for Million Dollar Baby, which is probably one of the first ones you would have seen from or from Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I think that's one of my first ones.
But yeah, like, you know, this was at a time we weren't really giving one movie multiple wins. So it got four here. I think it won one or two others somewhere else. But there were a few that it lost where I was sort of like, oh, that's interesting. Like, you know, I wouldn't have expected it to lose there, but it did.
Yeah, it kind of looks like Unforgiven, Scent of a Woman, and then Howard's End each kind of got...
A few.
Yeah. Like, they were kind of the top three of the year, and it kind of looks like they got kind of spread out a little bit. So, last week, and I could be wrong, but I think last week you kind of teased that Clint Eastwood is one of your favorite director-actor... combos.
Not one of my favorite, but I do think he's probably one of the best.
He's probably,
like, he will probably go down as one of the greatest, just in terms of the movies that he made and how successful they all were. And, like, not only was he acting and directing, but, like, he was directing himself, which is quite difficult. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Some actors will act here and then direct a movie over here, but not necessarily act in their own movie. He was doing both for a really long time. And I think, yeah, like, just, like, the longevity, like, he's had a directing career as long as somebody like Scorsese or Spielberg.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know if he's made as many sort of grade A classics as those guys have. But the fact that he's been doing it for this long, like, you got to kind of hold your hands up and be like, yeah, he's pretty fucking good
at it. He's
good. He's pretty good at it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think he'll definitely go down as one of the greatest.
My final question, though, because you are a Western person.
Yeah.
John Wayne or Clint Eastwood? Who's the better Western person?
Who's the better?
Yeah.
So I... Clint made better movies.
Okay.
But, like, John Wayne is kind of my guy. Like, okay. I don't know. Like, he has a confusing and conflicting history that, you know, there's a large parts of me is like, I don't like that. But yeah, like, the movies that he made, that is quite literally what I grew up on.
Should we tell everybody your John Wayne story?
Well, I have a few, but I think I know the one you're alluding to, where I broke down into tears because
he died.
I didn't know the history of the Alamo. Anyone who doesn't know that, the Americans don't win. And, you know, John Wayne may have played Genghis Khan once upon a time, but he was certainly not playing a Mexican.
Yeah.
He gets it at the end of The Alamo, and I was not prepared for that whatsoever.
And I think that's when our parents had to explain that this was movies and that he would come back and it's okay.
Well, like, I understood that him dying in a movie didn't mean that he was dying in real life.
Okay.
I understood that.
Okay.
What I think I didn't understand was that by that stage, I had seen dozens of John Wayne Westerns and war movies and things like that. And he's always killing people that I then never saw again. And so I think there was a part in my head where it's sort of like, oh, he's dead now, which means that they don't want to make movies with him anymore. So there'll be no more movies. I also didn't fully understand that, like, by the time I was watching these movies were like 40 years old.
Yeah.
And, like, there was a lot that I hadn't seen. I thought he was making them. So I think in my head, I assumed that because he was dead in this movie, it meant that he was never going to make another movie again, which then meant I was never going to see another movie again.
Okay.
So that is probably why I was breaking. Like, I'm full on tears. I ran upstairs. I could not handle it. I've never watched the second half of The Alamo again.
No?
No. It's also kind of boring.
Oh,
it's
okay. That's the real reason.
It's not a great one.
Watched the first half?
No.
Oh, okay.
I've never watched the first half again either because it is kind of boring. He has way, 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 way better movies than that. But yeah, I think Clint has definitely made the better movies. I think, like, there was there was a moment when I was maybe 15 or 16, and like really getting into movies. And because I had grown up on the John Wayne Westerns in particular, I then started to discover the spaghetti Westerns that were made in Italy.
Is that what a spaghetti Western is? Because I saw notes on spaghetti Westerns.
Spaghetti Westerns were made by Europeans.
Okay.
Mostly Italians.
Okay.
And so when I kind of discovered those, that's when like the door really kind of unlocked. Because like the John Wayne Westerns, even though I loved them, were kind of all, a lot of them were the same.
Okay.
At the end of the day. And then all of a sudden these showed up and like they were filmed better. There probably wasn't better performances in them because they were, a lot of the actors were overdubbed in English and things like that. But like they were, by this stage I was growing up, I was getting interested into more sort of dark and serious things. And then all of a sudden I found these Westerns that were giving me that. And so I've fully just embraced the spaghetti Westerns, and Clint Eastwood was in a lot of them. And so then it was sort of like, oh, these are better than those. But like I can point to something like Rio Bravo, 5 out of 5 movie. The Searchers, 5 out of 5 movie. Like there are a lot of the classic John Wayne Westerns where you're just like, those are fucking perfect. And there's not a lot you can take away from them. But Clint probably made the better Westerns.
Okay.
Yeah.
So next week?
Next week is the 2010 winner? No.
2009, I think. It came out in 2008, so it must be 2009.
Winner. Yeah, so next week is the 2009 winner. You haven't seen, or have you seen it?
I think I have.
Okay.
Because it's, I'm looking at...
It's the 2010 one that you haven't seen.
I think it was the 2010 one that I haven't seen. So yeah, this one came out 2009, and it was the first Best Picture to be directed by a woman.
Yep.
So I think I definitely saw it. I think either before the Oscars or very shortly after. So
we'll get into it next week, but I was fully in the bag for this movie.
Were you?
I was like, God, I hope this one wins. So yeah, that'll be next week. We'll get into it then.
See you everybody then.